Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. The Rose Art Museum at Brandeis University has threatened to close due to economic pressures. Could this represent an alarming trend in the world of university art institutions? We'll talk about that. But first, in 1933, at the height of the Great Depression, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt launched an ambitious program to stimulate the economy and provide work for millions of unemployed Americans, including artists. As a result, more than 1,200 original works of art were installed in post office lobbies throughout the country, including here in Pennsylvania. In commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the New Deal, the State Museum of Pennsylvania is presenting a special exhibit titled A Common Canvas, Pennsylvania's New Deal Post Office Murals, which runs now through May 17th. We'll find out more about it. Let's take note with David Lembeck, who has studied Pennsylvania's post office art and architecture for more than a decade and is currently serving as a Commonwealth Speaker for the Pennsylvania Humanities Council. David Lembeck, welcome to the program.
Hello, Patty.
In 1933, more than 14 million Americans were out of work. 9 million had lost their life savings, and millions of others lost their homes due to foreclosure. That sounds like a familiar scenario.
Yes, it does. And like what's happening now, the government was involved in creating various stimulus packages. FDR embarked on massive public works projects, which resulted in the construction of many of the things like courthouses, post offices, bridges, dams, to help stimulate the economy.
Where did this idea of commissioning artists to decorate these federal buildings that were part of the project, where did that come from?
A number of FDR's friends were interested in the arts, and one in particular, George Biddle, who was a lawyer and artist in Philadelphia and a former classmate of FDR, wrote to him to suggest that 1% of the money used for the construction of these projects be used to commission artists to decorate these federal buildings.
How did the public feel about money going to decorate buildings?
I think for the most part, they liked it. We're talking about a very small amount of money, typically between $500 and $800. So really not a lot of money. And the public was pretty supportive of this. As the U.S. got closer to entering World War II in the early 40s, I think the public then suggested that money, all money, should be directed towards the war effort.
Now, the money for the mural project, it didn't come from the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, which most people are familiar with. This actually came from a separate account from the Treasury Department. Explain that funding source.
That's right. There were actually several art projects during the New Deal, and the ones that decorated federal buildings, like courthouses and post offices, came from the Treasury's Section of Fine Arts. And this was a separate project from the WPA, and it had its own rules and its own sort of aesthetic agenda.
They refer to it simply as the section, and the section, as you said, had its own agenda and its own rules. Give us an idea of what the artists were charged with and how the artists were chosen.
The artists were chosen in blind competitions. This was really not a relief project per se, and it was open to all artists. So there was a variety of artists from very well-established, well-known artists down to very young, unknown artists in their 20s. The section wanted artists to create works of art that were realistic. They referred to this as being in the American scene style. And they wanted the subject matter to be things that people in towns could relate to, images of their everyday life or scenes from the town's history.
And even though scenes of everyday life during the Great Depression might have included bread lines, this is not something that that was encouraged or used by any of the artists. These were all positive, uplifting images.
That's right. That's a very good point. You can see images of unemployed people or breadlines in some of the other projects from the WPA, but the artworks that you'll find in federal buildings is very much uplifting. It's meant to encourage people, show the sort of a rugged American spirit. Remember, the people in charge of these projects viewed the Depression as a temporary phenomenon, and they didn't want these kinds of permanent reminders on the walls for decades. So yeah, they're very positive images, and in that respect, the Section of Fine Arts made sure that artists did not portray the more negative aspects of the Depression.
In fact, Life magazine referred to this artwork as Mural America for Rural America. And there were certainly some taboo topics. There are also a lot of juicy controversies that surrounded what could and couldn't be used in post offices. Tell us about some of the more interesting stories. I'm thinking of Renova and the artist there who did use this a little bit as a political message.
The Renova mural, which is beautiful and in great shape, shows the town's major industry, which is the repair of railroad cars. And one of the things the Section of Fine Arts did not want artists to engage in was sort of pro-labor, pro-union sentiments. In the murals across the country, there's really no strife between labor and management. Labor and management work shoulder to shoulder, and that's what you see in Renova. But the artist, Harold Lehman, was very much a pro-union man, and he wanted to show support for the unions who worked in the rail car shops up there. So he painted into the caps of the workers these little buttons, which were the union buttons, showed that these workers were members of the two unions there, and that was his sort of subtle show of support. The Section of Fine Arts never noticed this in the mural because they only had 8x10 black and white photographs to go by. So when the photograph arrived, they never even noticed it. It looked like a tiny dot.
And we must point out that when these murals were installed, citizens, if they found things that were inaccurate, a lot of them were up in arms.
That's right. There was another example in Gannett, Pennsylvania. One of the two murals in that post office was called Battle of Bushy Run. And the artist, it shows a battle between American settlers, Scottish Highlanders, against French allied Indians. And the artist showed the Scottish Highlanders with rifles, but not showing bayonets, which apparently was an important historical detail. And the town was so upset about this that after much letter writing, the Section of Fine Arts ordered the artist to go in and paint bayonets into the mural even after it was installed.
There were 1,200 post office murals installed across the country. How many of them ended up in Pennsylvania?
We received 88 commissions, a very large percentage. Only New York State has more post office artwork.
Can you tell us a little bit about the caliber of artist? You said this was a nationwide blind competition, but there were some very fine artists out there, and in Pennsylvania, a lot of important influences.
That's right. Some of the artists who were very famous at the time may not be familiar names now, but an artist named Gifford Beale did a number of murals for the Allentown Post Office. An artist named George Harding did murals in Philadelphia and Wilkes-Barre. A woman known as the Female Rodin did a wonderful sculpture in a town called Mahanoy City. Other artists who were unknown at the time became quite famous. I'm thinking of George Rickey, who painted a mural in Sealands Grove and later became a very famous kinetic metal sculptor.
You mentioned sculptures, and Pennsylvania had more commissioned sculptures than any other state with 42%. Tell us a little bit about the sculptures, and are these things that people will also find when they visit their local post office?
Nearly half the artworks in Pennsylvania are sculptures, usually carved from wood or stone, sometimes cast in aluminum. There are some very unusual pieces in Ford City in southwestern Pennsylvania. The sculpture is actually sandblasted Carrara glass, which celebrates the glass industry there.
And even some, I think, murals done on slate to celebrate the slate industry in Pennsylvania.
That one is in Bangor, Pennsylvania. Yes, and that was the slate belt capital of the world. It produced most of the chalkboards for the country.
Now, some of these murals and artwork has vanished over the years. I think we've lost maybe 10%. Give us an idea of the condition that these pieces are in and how many post offices still have this artwork hanging in their facilities.
Of the 80 post offices in Pennsylvania that received artworks, about 80 are still there. So a pretty good percentage. Some of the artworks over the years were painted over or destroyed. Sometimes the sculpture was just given away. I think there's a real appreciation now for what's there, and there's an attempt to preserve it. Some of the murals are in need of a cleaning. Post office lobbies are not art galleries. There are fluctuations of temperature and humidity, and dirt accumulates. But most of them clean up pretty well.
I'm wondering from a conservation standpoint if one medium is better, because I know a lot of these murals were painted on canvas. Some were actually painted directly on the wall. So in terms of conserving, was one a better way to do it than the other?
The frescoes, paint or painting directly on plaster, is supposed to be a more permanent approach to wall painting, but it has its own problems. When a post office lobby is remodeled, often the artwork is destroyed. So in some respects, painting on canvas and then adhering it to the wall gives a conservator more flexibility to remove the artwork and replace it later.
You refer in an article that you wrote about this, you refer to the post office murals as the people's art and say that these murals gave many residents their very first encounter with an original work of art. How important was all of this, not only to lifting spirits, but to exposing the public to something they might not have seen otherwise?
Really, before the 1950s, America was considered sort of a second-rate power in terms of art. And many small communities had only seen artworks and reproductions. The projects were unusual in that it was sort of a three-way partnership between the artist, the townspeople, and the administrators in Washington. The townspeople had tremendous input in terms of what subject matter they wanted the artist to portray and how they wanted to have themselves shown.
Speaking of how people were portrayed, I know a lot of these murals have white males as the heroes in a lot of the scenes. How were women portrayed, and how were Native Americans and African Americans, who were certainly a part of the early settlement of this country, but not perhaps shown as much as the others?
That's a very complex issue, but you're right. The sort of the world shown in these murals is very much the world of white males. Women are usually shown in supporting roles, but we do have some exceptions. In Muncie, Pennsylvania, it celebrates a heroine named Rachel Silverthorne, who warned settlers of an upcoming British and Indian attack. In Tunkhannock, it shows women defending a small band of settlers with guns. In terms of Native Americans, it's very interesting because the way they're portrayed depends on what part of the state you're in. In southeastern Pennsylvania, in and around Philadelphia, the harmonious relations between white settlers and Indians is celebrated. But as you go farther north and west, it's much more a display of warfare and hostilities between them. African Americans are not shown very much. It's very much like I think of Hollywood films of that time, where just not shown at all or in very supportive roles.
The State Museum of Pennsylvania is presenting this special exhibit titled A Common Canvas, Pennsylvania's New Deal Post Office Murals, now through May 17th. David Lembeck, who has studied Pennsylvania's post office art and architecture, is currently serving as a Commonwealth Speaker for the Pennsylvania Humanities Council. David Lembeck, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Patty.
You're listening to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. The Rose Art Museum at Brandeis University threatened to close and sell off its collection due to economic pressures. For now, at least, there's been a reprieve, but major staff cuts are pending. Could this represent an alarming trend in the world of university art institutions? Let's take note with Jan Muellert, director of Penn State's Palmer Museum of Art. Jan Muellert, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
The Palmer Museum of Art is in no immediate financial danger, although arts funding is being cut all around the country due to the economic downturn. Describe the current situation.
Well, yes, indeed, the Palmer Museum is fortunate to have some sound footing, thanks to Penn State. But nationally, there are alarming events. It seems to have started about 3 years ago at Fisk University. I can get into that later if you're interested. And with Randolph College, that used to be Randolph-Macon Women's College, about a year and a half ago, The trustees and president wanted to sell off some of the collection. Then it's happening in other kinds of museums, but the art museums, in some cases, the trustees look at the collection as like a bank, that they can perhaps sell off some of those assets. And we all in the business get very nervous when they start talking about collections, works of art, as assets.
Well, it's interesting because the one art director at a museum in Detroit says the institute is there to safeguard the art. The art is not there to support the institution.
Absolutely. And certainly institutions like the Palmer Museum and Brandeis in particular, too, have received their collections through many gifts. 75% of our collection came to us through gifts of works of art or money to buy works of art. So, yes, we feel, though, quite sure in the Association of Art Museum Directors that is looking over what's happening that we can weather this storm, but we do need to educate people, and our trustees in particular, to understand that the collection is not a bank account.
The Palmer Museum of Art opened 37 years ago, back in October of 1972, and at the time there were only three galleries and there was no permanent collection. Describe the Palmer Museum today. What are its strengths? What do people think of when they think of the Palmer Museum?
Yes, indeed. When it opened, it didn't have a collection, but within its first year, the Palmer had 100 works of art. Today, we have over 6,000 works of art in the collection. And as I said, almost 75% of those have come through gift. Our strengths, thanks to the founding director, Bill Hull, are in American art, painting, sculpture, and works on paper. So that being such a strength is something that we can talk about as far as its use by our faculty and students, but also in the community, because teachers use our collection for their American history courses. And that's very important to us, and so we help those teachers do it.
Do most universities have museums of art? And you've sort of alluded to this, but what role do they play in the academic and cultural life of a university?
Very significant. There are varying degrees, though. Some museums are almost solely there to serve the university community. And then others, like the Palmer, are very much a balance between serving the broader community or the region, in our case, as well as faculty and students and staff. Here, we work with not only Art History Department and the School of Visual Arts, but there's other faculty and students from, for example, Liberal Arts, Communications, the College of Communications, Business. So we do reach out, and they do use the museum for their different purposes, either for writing, learning how to describe things. Perhaps you've also heard some programs where in criminal law and, you know, training of police, they're bringing people into museums to learn how to look and then describe what they see.
It's interesting that you say that because in researching this topic, I looked at what other universities had in terms of museums, and I loved what the Yale University had to say about their museum, which to many, to the uninitiated, a museum may seem highbrow or elite. And Yale says, we want you to find a way in. And the best way to find a way into something is to look closely and ask a lot of questions. So I'm curious to know about your professional staff and how important trained docents are to helping people really see what's there.
Well, our curator of education works closely with our core of volunteer docents. They number about 35. We have a number of men in that group. Sometimes you think that only women volunteer. They do tend to specialize in certain areas, so that's why we need so many docents. So those who like working with young people will do the K through 12 talks, and then adults, vice versa. But I think you need to have many hours of looking, talking, and then testing, seeing how people understand a work of art after you get them to look at it. I have one, when we do our community day, I have a large painting that is mainly just flowing color. There's nothing that people can't see what's in it. So they're standing there and say, "What is that?" So then my challenge is to get them to stop and look, and then I talk him into it, and then they stand there and say, "Wow, that's neat." So it's that kind of challenge that you kind of relish.
They're either saying, "What is it?" or "I could do that."
Oh, yes. I've had those conversations too with certainly with abstract expressionism, with the the drip paintings and the slashing of paint all over a large canvas. I had an argument with a painter. That's somebody who paints walls, and he was working in the gallery, and he was not near this particular painting, but he looked over at it and indicated, "I could do that." Of course, that's when you really cringe when somebody says that. then you have to take a deep breath, and then just
start educating.
Right.
We began our discussion by talking about Brandeis University, and 3 months ago they announced that they would close the Rose Art Museum and sell its $350 million collection. There was a reprieve, and at least until fall, the museum will continue to be open, but there are plans now for the museum to continue without a director. So I'm curious to know, what does a director do, and what do you think of a university museum without a director?
Well, they're going to have somebody there, maybe not a museum director, but certainly a manager to run the operation, however they redo it or refocus it. I think their comments about refocusing it to be more academic and more focused on the teaching aspect, that's really questionable, because museums are educational institutions. One of our primary missions is to educate. So how they're going to refocus a museum that's already devoted to education, I'm not so sure.
You've worked with museums both in and out of academia. You worked in Fort Worth, Texas for a public museum, and at the University of Iowa Museum of Art. How does a university art museum differ from a public museum of art?
Well, I think, again, you could just use the Palmer, and certainly at University of Iowa the same way. If you're able to have that nice balance between community support as well as university support, you really you can sustain that institution for decades. If you're a little balance out of balance and it's leaning too much one way or another, I believe that's when trouble begins.
Art councils throughout the country have been asking arts organizations to report on how the economic downturn is affecting their bottom line. And the majority of them said that they are seeing some serious downturns in earned and contributed income. And one of the most disturbing national trends is that donors are reneging on their donations, in part because of how much they've lost in the stock market. To what extent is that a problem for you at the Palmer?
Well, we are seeing a decline in funding or contributions. We're not losing members so much as the members are not able to continue donating at the levels they had been just 6 months ago. But at least it's promising they're staying with us, and we can only hope and assume that when things turn the other way, they'll come back.
Your annual gala will be held on May 8th. Tell us a little bit about the event and why these are such important fundraisers.
Well, this year certainly is going to be critical. The funds that we raise at the gala dinner and auction they're turned into funding for our all our education programs, some acquisitions, and some of our exhibitions. So they're critical funds to keep us going.
Many museums are laying off staff. We mentioned what might be happening at Brandeis University. They're postponing exhibitions. They're looking locally so that they're not having to spend so much on transporting arts to their institution. They're looking for new ways to raise money. And I'm wondering if there's something in particular that the Palmer Museum is doing to weather the storm.
Just being more frugal. Certainly, looking at the exhibitions we're planning and worrying about the shipping expenses, which have increased, and we don't see those going away either. So, yes, we are trying to spread payments out for exhibitions. We're also seeing that organizations, traveling exhibition service organizations, they're giving discounts on their services. So everybody is looking for ways to share costs and cut costs.
And while the Obama administration is not creating anything like the Works Progress Administration to help the arts, he is supportive of spending tax dollars on aesthetics. Can you comment briefly on how encouraged you are by his administration?
I think we are all very encouraged because a good indication is that he authorized a 1% increase for NEA, National Endowment for the Arts. That's a great sign. We can hope that it'll be brighter in the future.
Jan Muellert is director of Penn State's Palmer Museum of Art. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia.
This program was produced in the studios of WPSU. If you have a story idea for Take Note, send it to WPSU, 120 Outreach Building, University Park, Pennsylvania, 16802. Or email it to wpsu@psu.edu. This has been a presentation of Penn State Public Broadcasting.